And welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. I'm Douglas Simpoga in Washington. Today is Sunday, February 19th, and here are some of the stories we're covering. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres says many African countries have been denied needed debt relief and concession financing.
A dysfunctional and unfair global financial system that denies many African countries the debt relief and the concessional financing they need.
Ghanaians are mourning Christian Asu, the professional footballer who was found dead under the building where he lived in southern Turkey after a massive earthquake over a week ago.
It's a bit of sadness and a greater grief, especially for those who were close to him. For all those who were not close to him, it's heartbreaking news because of his good self. You know, he never had any bad issues around him. He never had any bad reportage around Christian Achuan.
And voter registration in the Democratic Republic of Congo begins in northern Kivu province as the M23 rebel offensive continues north of the city of Goma. Those and more coming up on Nightline Africa. United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres says many African countries have been denied needed debt relief and concession of financing. He commented Saturday at a news conference held after the opening of African Union Summit in Addis Ababa. Maya Miskir reports from Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, where the AU is headquartered.
The UN Secretary General said Saturday that African countries are being denied needed debt relief, noting that because of a lack of financial support, the African continent is facing a very difficult situation. Speaking at a news conference held at African Union headquarters, Secretary General Antonio Guterres said in order to draw on the continent's potential, a series of challenges must first be overcome.
A dysfunctional and unfair global financial system that denies many African countries the debt relief and the concessional financing they need. Systems and structures, from health and education to social protection, job creation, and gender equality, are starved of investment for lack of support.
Guterres mentioned the impact that debt has on the continent's economy in his remarks earlier in the day at the opening ceremony of the AU summit. He emphasized that developing African countries are often left out when global investment lenders create their financial plans.
African countries cannot invest in these critical areas and climb the development ladder with one hand tied between their backs, behind their backs.
Guterres pointed out that Africa is dramatically underrepresented at the United Nations Security Council and at Bretton Woods institutions.
We need a new debt architecture that provides debt relief and restructuring to vulnerable countries, including middle-income countries, while providing immediate debt suspension and write-downs to countries in need.
AU Commission Chairperson Moussa Faki Mohamed made the opening remarks to kick off the AU summit and was followed by Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. The opening ceremony included the handover of the AU chairmanship from Senegalese President Macky Sall to Comoros President Azali Assoumani. The theme of this year's AU Assembly is Year of AFCFTA, Acceleration of the African Continental Free Trade Area. Maya Musakir for VOA News, Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
Direct from Washington, the Voice of America, VOA.
Ghanaians are mourning Christian Asu, who was found dead under the building where he lived in southern Turkey after a massive earthquake. The 31-year-old soccer player had been missing since February 6. Asu joined the Turkish football club Hatayspor in September after spells with English Premier League clubs Everton, Chelsea and Newcastle United. Kevin Awusu Ansa is a journalist at TV3 in Accra, Ghana. He tells me that in Accra, even those who didn't personally know Asu are grieving.
Well, I think It's been a mixed reaction in here in Accra. It's a bit of sadness and a greater grief, especially for those who were close to him. For all those who were not close to him, it's heartbreaking news because of his good self. You know, he never had any bad issues around him. He never had any bad reportage around Christian Achiu. And for the brilliance that he was, especially for the national team, for the period that he played for Ghana until he decided to stay off national duties. A lot have been grieved. And you go through the entire shows throughout the country and it's all been about Christian Achiu, celebrating him, eulogizing him in sadness, in grief. You go to social media and it's almost every post, every 10 posts has 8 of them being around Christian Achiu. WhatsApp statuses, you look at it and it's arguably been the same thing for even people who did not know him but come to realize that this was someone who was benevolent towards the society. It's been a downcast moment for everyone in Ghana.
Yeah, as you say, even those who didn't know him personally knew him at least as a national football team player, so, and he must have had several fans. They must be really disheartened.
Well, they are very much disheartened, and especially for those who have come to read about him, especially when in the last 9 days when the incident happened, and then a lot of reports have been going around, circulating around Christian Achiu and who he was, who he is. And I think I had an interview with him back in 2021, about 32 or 35 minutes, talking about his life and what he had to do, his career and everything. And people just went on to look at the video and you just look at the comments, you read the comments that were being poured out and it clearly tells you that in as much as he wasn't too much in the public eye, at least the little that he's done, his self-esteem, his personality appeals so much to each and everyone, especially getting to know that he was someone who was helping the needy, the afflicted, and then the sick. He's become more like a national hero, even when he wasn't celebrated during his lifetime playing football and then living his life here in Ghana and then abroad as a professional footballer. So it's been a very difficult moment for everyone who has come close to this news, even for those who may seem indifferent about footballers be dying, and then even some who have been so much celebrated on the continent and even in Ghana here, Achiu's case has become a different one and more like a legacy that is going to be celebrated for years to come.
We heard a statement from the government. What do you know of his returning the body to Ghana and maybe his funeral? Do we know anything yet?
Yes, we know. So in less than 24 hours, so Ghana time, 7 p.m., we are expecting the body to be here. That is Sunday. So that is about 21 hours from now. We are expecting Christian Achiu's body to be here in Ghana, and it was going to be received by the Ghana Armed Forces, that is the military, here at the Kotoka International Airport. And then the state will liaise with the family to finalize whatever arrangements that need to be done before the final burial rites and funeral rites are arranged eventually.
That was Kevin Awusu Ansah, a journalist at TV3 in Accra, Ghana. Following the Russian invasion of Ukraine 1 year ago, 38 African countries condemned the aggression, while 18 African countries abstained in a UN General Assembly vote. But later they failed to speak out against Russia's continued brutal war in Ukraine and cooperated with Moscow. William Lawrence, a professor of international relations at the American University in Washington, explained why to VOA's senior analyst Mohamed El Shanawi.
Now, of the various votes, the 16 to 19 countries that have been abstaining, If you drill down on the individual statements, they say generally that they agree that Ukraine shouldn't be invaded, but they don't want to take side in a European conflict between a Western bloc and an Eastern bloc, and to have good relations with both sides. Now, if you drill down even further, it gets kind of interesting. Not only are they not voting with Russia, but Russia is doing a huge effort in Africa that is not to help populations or even states, but to help African elites that it's aligned with. Unlike the U.S., which is the number one private investor in Africa, or China or the EU, which are the number one public investors, Russia doesn't invest. Instead, they send mercenaries, they have arms for resource deals, opaque contracts, and they do election interference and disinformation. And a lot of what they do is prop up authoritarian leaders. At any one time, Russia's only prioritizing 5 to 10 countries in Africa. They don't have much bandwidth in their foreign policy and in their trade and investment policy, you know, whereas the U.S. will be dealing with and investing in 45 or 50 countries of 54. So this both-sidism of the African countries, there's a lot of reasons for it, post-colonial reasons. But I think what's missing is, while a lot of the African sentiment comes out of their negative experience of European colonialism, they don't recognize that modern Russian imperialism is kind of the same thing. And what Russia's doing in Ukraine is as bad as, you know, all the European colonial experience as well. The other thing that's left out is there are about 10 countries that haven't been abstaining. They've been no voting. And a number of them are African. The most prominent one that's been looked at is Morocco. But what's really going on is they don't want to even give a neutral position, which is the position. They want to give a no position so as to not upset anyone. So they want to be seen as not even joining Russia's effort to get abstentions at the UN, but they want to be seen as not even participating in the positions and the process. So no country squarely in the Russian camp in Africa except Eritrea. Instead, they want to defend these opaque relationships with elites, you know, at the expense of economic development and human rights. And hopefully, you know, over time, African elites and African civil society can start looking at these Russian contracts and ask for transparency from their governments and have a higher level of scrutiny of the deals being made and push back on the Russian interference in elections and Russian disinformation in media and social media, which was, of course, a big feature of Lavrov's recent visit.
But 1 year after the Russian invasion of Ukraine, some African countries are welcoming the Russian foreign minister with open arms for cooperation. Would that mean many African countries are becoming more focused on their economic and security interests over international efforts to isolate Russia?
Only in the sense that Russia is the number one arms supplier to Africa. But Russia props up autocratic regimes with a couple of exceptions. So look where Lavrov went. Eritrea, arguably the worst governed country in Africa. Eswatini, which gets the silver medal or the bronze medal for that. There's been a spate of coups in Africa in 2021 and 2022. And he goes to those countries, Mali, Sudan, others. And then very undemocratic countries like Angola and Mauritania. I mean, the only outlier here is South Africa. And now South Africa has its unique history and orientation towards the West and its geostrategic concerns. But then, you know, look at what's actually going on in Lavrov's visit. He got no new economic deals of note, except possibly a nuclear deal for Angola. And then you have the South Africa question. But that's gotten a huge reaction from the South African opposition and big play in the U.S. press that South Africa, with its anti-imperialist history, is dealing with a predatory imperialist state. So, you know, is Russia winning the propaganda war, which is what a lot of the press coverage was saying? No, I don't think it is. You know, the vast majority of states and societies around the world are against Russia. What I would hope over time is that people in Africa begin to understand that when you're defending Russia or playing both sidesism here, you're sort of going along with Russian imperialism.
That was William Lawrence, professor of international relations at the American University in Washington. The voter registration process in the Democratic Republic of Congo began on Thursday in North Kivu province as the M23 rebel offensive continues north of the city of Goma. Tens of thousands of internally displaced persons who cannot return to their villages must register in the camps that are hosting them. From Goma, reporter Zenem Neti Zaid has the story.
In the camp of Kanyaruchinya, located north of the city of Goma, Jean-Baptiste Sebujangwe was among the displaced people who were able to receive their voter's card. This was a relief for him because they had been living without any identification since they fled from Rugari, a locality to which he hopes to return soon. He says he has been displaced by the fighting and has just received his voter's card. He says he feels free and happy to have an ID again. In these first days of registration, long lines are being observed at the registration center in Kanyaruchinya. Displaced people there complain that electoral commission agents are taking longer than expected to register voters. The military governor of North Kivu, in a speech on the day of the launch of registration drive, said the Congolese army is doing everything possible to reconquer the areas controlled by the M23 rebels in the territory of Ruchuru, Masisi and Nyiragongo to allow the inhabitants to take part in the elections. For his part, the military administrator of Nyiragongo territory, Colonel Patrick Duma, says security in the centers will be maintained throughout the process. He says that in each office they have placed two policemen. He says that in his area there are 21 enrollment centers and he has visited all of them. There are no problems. He asks the public to be vigilant and to denounce foreigners who are not Congolese nationals but who often try to register. The registration of voters for the upcoming December polls is starting, but several localities in North Kivu, in the east of the country, are occupied by the M23 and are not accessible to electoral commission agents. I'm Zanem Netizaidin Goma for VOA Africa.
Stay engaged with VOA Africa. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message, comments, or greetings. Dial the international code +1, then 202-258-3076. The number again is the international code +1, then 202-258-3076.
In South Africa, the anti-poverty and pro-justice group Oxfam is calling for communities impacted by mining to have a seat at the table. This, the organization says, will empower them to be informed before giving consent to activities that impact their lives. Oxfam is also calling for an end to what it says is the unjust embrace of an energy transition that favors wealthy nations over developing countries. The calls follow the recent 14th annual alternative mining Indaba in Cape Town, South Africa, with the theme, A Just Energy Transition, Unlocking Community Potential and Participation. For more on the calls, VOA's Peter Clote reached Dales George. She's Oxfam's program director for the Southern African region.
Here as well, we think that African governments really need to award for community participation in the formulation of the energy transition policies so that then they can respond to the contextual realities of people's livelihoods and economies. And so we think that the communities have the lived experience of extraction. And most of the time, this is an experience without even them, you know, benefiting from the proceeds of mining. We also see how communities are displaced. And in countries like Mozambique, for example, there's wars and conflicts, resource wars and conflicts. And some of them, like Cabo, where I come from in Zambia, people are surviving in degraded lands and they experience different forms of inequality.
But do you think having them at the table will have any impact on the decision by these miners or these mining companies to carry out the activities of mining, which is profit-driven?
We've seen in the past that the people in mining communities have really not benefited, and partly because this aspect of free, prior and informed consent has not been respected. And when we start to think around governments strengthening protection, you know, and participation of people, and ensure that they have the informed consent, and you know, they are, you know, centered in the decisions that affect them, we think that that's a starting point. So, like I said earlier, the communities need to fully understand what this transition is all about and the implications on their lives for them to be able to, you know, participate in the policies and the political processes that are shaping these spaces.
Talking about energy transition that usually favors wealthy countries against developing countries, this most people say is unjust and must change. Why is Oxfam saying this must change, and what form do you think that could help change this?
Well, it's unjust in so many ways, and it really must change because if you look at Africa as a continent, they have the resources, they have the land, the water, the gas, the oil, the minerals that really the whole world needs for them to prosper. But if you look at the economic growth in African countries that hold these resources, it's nothing to write home about. We are talking about a continent that has seen energy poverty, you know, impacting about 700 to 800 million people in Africa. They have no access to energy. It's a huge contradiction in the sense that we cannot have massive resources in countries with a massive number of population being categorized as poor. If you look into the past, you will also note that Africa loses about 100 million a year in illicit financial flows. And a lot of that is because of the undisclosed contracts that have been crafted in the energy transition space. But if you were to look into the future, you will note that the energy sector will be influenced by technology. And there's an estimation of about 85 million jobs that will be earmarked in the energy sector. If you paid attention to COP27, they're talking about billions of dollars that are lined up for the energy sector. So the conversation needs to change because Africa needs to align with this agenda. They need to have a position. They need to have policy choices political choices that are made by governments in the interest of the poor.
There have been calls that mining companies and the sector should be held accountable for adverse effects of mining on the environment and should not be allowed to operate with impunity. How do you respond to this?
That's why all these calls are up, that governments must really strengthen and, like you put it, enforce protection, not just for human rights, but protection for land, for water and other resources, you know, that people depend on for their life and livelihood, and ensure that they actually contribute to realization of human rights and just having people with a dignified life. So mining companies, governments alike should not hide behind lower standards in national law when it comes to, you know, their accountabilities. They should actually ensure that they give paramount importance to advancing, you know, an agenda around the renewables in Africa that is responsive to the needs of the community.
That was Dales Judge, Oxfam's program director for the Southern African region. She was speaking to VOA's Peter Klote. Some South Sudan lawmakers and officials are calling on leaders to speed up preparations for holding elections next year. The head of the National Elections Commission says the government has yet to put in place the legal framework for conducting the vote. Wake Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
Several party officials say despite little activity by the country's leaders, they are preparing for elections at the end of the transitional period as required by the revitalized peace agreement. Some officials say they are registering party members, mobilizing new members, and establishing offices in states. Atem Kwol, Secretary for Political Affairs of the SPLM, says his party has mobilized members at the grassroots level.
We have gone down to the Bumas and Payams, reorganizing the members from Buma to Payam, from Payam to counties, then to the state. Then we are now preparing to conduct a national convention.
Kwal says the party will conduct a national convention this year to finalize internal arrangements before the elections.
National convention role is to choose who is going to be a flag bearer, who is going to be the chairman of the party. And at the same time, the chairman of the party, elected chairman, will be a flag bearer, who will contest for presidential seat.
Wilson Lodiong, vice president of the African National Congress, says his party is as well into preparations for next year's elections.
We are mobilizing our members and opening offices in the state. And we are mostly emphasizing and establishing our state offices and making recruitment for any eventuality that in case there's an election, then we go for election.
Lodiong says insecurity hinders efforts to mobilize and establish offices in some locations. He says the mistrust that still exists between some of the parties should be addressed to create a conducive environment for holding elections.
We are not seeing even the unified forces that can be unifying and conducive in Thomas elections. After now, the army are fragmented and we don't know which one is which. So this is our fear, that should election happen within this time frame and the army are not unified, then the results of the election will be one-sided.
Abednego Akok Kachual, chairperson of the South Sudan National Elections Commission, says lack of legal framework has slowed his agency's work.
This transitional period will end by 22nd of this month, and then we will be going on with the other 2 years remaining. I would really recommend them to say the election act should be passed very quickly, and then the formation of the election commission should be done. And from there, the commission will begin preparing the elections.
In August last year, President Salva Kiir's administration announced the extension of the transitional government's time in office for another 2 years. Akok is urging political parties to present a program for conducting elections now scheduled to take place in December 2024.
It is a matter of making a timetable. We have already constituencies which are existing in the country, and then we have the last census, and then we have the election commission, which is with the structure now. It is only two things, resources to be available, and then, as I told you before, the political will.
The peace agreement requires leaders to amend the Elections Act ahead of the elections. Akok and John Aganye, spokesperson for the National Legislative Assembly, told the VOA on Thursday the elections bill has yet to reach Parliament for ratification. Without parliamentary approval, elections cannot proceed. Akok and Aganye say the bill is still tied up with the Council of Ministers. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. And coming up in the second half of the program, sports. Then a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, and music from our African collection. February is U.S. Black History Month, and one of America's heroes of the 19th century is Harriet Tubman. Born in 1822 in Dorchester County, Maryland, Tubman helped scores of enslaved black Americans resist bondage and gain their freedom. Today, the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Visitor Center is open to the public just a mile or so from where Tubman grew up on Maryland's eastern shore. Dana Patera, park manager of the Visitor Center, explains to VOA's Carol Van Dam, Tubman's formative years were spent in Dorchester County.
She worked in the timber industry with her father. She trapped muskrats in the marshes. She was illiterate in the traditional sense, although the time that she spent in nature allowed her to hone skills that made her successful in her rescue mission. She was able to navigate the landscape by reading the stars and reading the signs of nature, and that helped her to guide her rescue missions successfully up and down the Eastern Shore 13 times.
She was a very courageous person, man or woman, just hands down. She's known as the Moses of her people. Can you explain that?
She was given that name by abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison because of her ability to successfully lead her people to freedom, just as Moses was able to lead the Israelites to the Promised Land.
Tell us a little more about what visitors will find when they enter the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Visitor Center.
Well, our focus here at the park is on Tubman's early years in the Choptank River region of Maryland. She was born Araminta Ross in 1822, and she spent her formative years in Madison, Church Creek area, Wolford, and Bucktown. And it was here that she learned outdoor survival, checking muskrats on the Little Blackwater River. And there were communities of both free and enslaved African Americans living in the shipbuilding towns of Madison, Wolford, and Church Creek, where the timber was being taken to be processed and shipped out. And it was here in these towns that Tubman interacted with blackjacks, or free African-American sailors, who taught her how to navigate by the stars.
People may not know that she escaped pretty much on her own, and then she went back several times, which was very dangerous, right?
Yes, absolutely. On September 17th of 1849, she made the decision to self-liberate. And once she reached Philadelphia and William Still's office, she realized that even though she was free, her friends, her family, her community were still enslaved. And so she made the gut-wrenching decision to risk her life to come back to Maryland's Eastern Shore, not once or twice, but at least 13 times to rescue at least 70 friends and family members.
And sometimes when people hear the term Underground Railroad, they think it's a real thing, but it's not a real thing.
Yes, and unfortunately, we still run into that. The Underground Railroad is a resistance movement. It's made up of whites, African Americans, men, women, basically abolitionists that do not believe slavery should be allowed.
And during that time, of course, it was the Civil War in this country, and Tubman served as a scout, a spy, and even a soldier for the Union Army. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yes. On June 1st, 1863, she became the first woman to plan and execute an armed expedition during the Civil War. And along with Colonel James Montgomery, they struck a devastating blow to plantations along South Carolina's Cumbie River. And over 700 recently freed enslaved people stormed the boats carrying everything they possibly could, pigs, chickens, children, food, and there was chaos and confusion, and it quickly turned into an alarming situation. And Colonel Montgomery turned to Moses and told her to calm her people. And Tubman took a deep breath, looked out at the crowds for about 2 minutes, and then began singing Glory until everyone joined in and the situation was under control enough to organize the safe evacuation of the 700 recently liberated.
That's Dana Patera, park manager at the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Center in Dorchester County, Maryland. She was speaking to my colleague Carol Van Dam from Church Creek, Maryland.
Stay engaged with VOA Africa. You can call us 24/7 on WhatsApp and leave a message, comments, or greetings. Dial the international code +1 then 202-258-3076. The number again is the international code +1 then 202-258-3076.
And now in Nateland Africa Sports, let's go straight to Abuja and join Samson O'Malley. Hi, Samson.
Hi, Douglas, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Former Chelsea and Newcastle United player Christian Atsu has been found dead after the earthquake that struck Turkey and Syria nearly 2 weeks ago. The 31-year-old, who moved to Hatayspor in September 2022, has been missing since the earthquake that struck southern and central Turkey, as well as northern and western Syria on February 6th. Atsu's body was found under the earthquake rubble in the city of Hatay. In women's football, Cameroon earned a hard-fought 2-0 victory against Thailand as the final qualifying playoffs for the 2023 FIFA Women's World Cup began in New Zealand on Saturday. Cameroon, who reached the last 16 at the 2015 and 2019 World Cups, triumphed at the Wakiato Stadium in Hamilton following two late goals from substitute Gabriel Onguene. But it was a chaotic match that featured 24 minutes of added time. Cameroon will now face Portugal in Hamilton on Wednesday to secure one of the three remaining spots. The CAF Under 20 Africa Cup of Nations is set to begin in the North African country on Sunday. It will last until the 11th of March 2023. The biennial competition is one of the most popular with African football fans, as it has consistently revealed young stars who subsequently become world-class players. 12 teams are taking part in this 23rd edition. They include Egypt, Senegal, Nigeria, Mozambique, Uganda, Central African Republic, South Sudan, Congo, The Gambia, Tunisia, Benin, and Zambia. The teams that reach the semifinals will automatically qualify for the FIFA Under 20 World Cup Indonesia from 20th of May to the 11th of June 2023. Flying Eagles of Nigeria head coach Ladan Bosu is confident his team will make the semifinals in Egypt.
Our least target is to be the best. And if for you to be the best, you must prepare a team that will beat the best.
Uganda Under-20 national side, the Hippos, will play their opening group game in the Under-20 African Cup of Nations against Central African Republic. But the Hippos coach, Mayanja, is concerned that the cold winter conditions in Egypt might take its toll on his players.
The weather is really so. It's very cold, and this has not been the same thing in Kampala. The good thing at Kampala.
In athletics, Ugandan's Jacob Kiplimo on Saturday won gold at the 2023 World Cross Country Race in Australia. Kiplimo clocked 29 minutes 17 seconds around the 10-kilometer long course at the Mount Panorama in Bathurst, northwest of Sydney, better known as one of the world's most challenging motor racing courses. And finally, in cycling news, four-time Tour de France winner Chris Froome and his Israel Premier Team will headline this year's much-anticipated Tour de Rwanda 2023 race, which begins on Sunday. And that's all for this week's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Douglas.
Thanks, Samson.
Direct from Washington, the voice of America, VOA.
Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospects in time of conflict, in times of peace. Here is one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. By the end of this week, the 25th to be precise, over 90 million Nigerian voters are expected to go to the polls to elect their new executive presidents, governors, and legislatures for the countries. Africans have always paid attention to Nigeria's election because the country holds the largest African population, has the greatest economy, and has been playing key diplomatic roles in the continent. At the beginning of the campaign for this election, there were expectations that this time around, Nigeria's elections may prove more fruitful. The key to this expectation was the idea that the youth of Nigeria, who in the past have not turned out in large numbers to vote, will do so this time, mainly to back their preferred candidate, Peter Obi, of the Labour Party. The registration was very active, and everyone was expecting to have a smooth election. And there were some even predictions that the next president will not come from the two traditional parties, the PDP and the APC. Even though these two parties were fielding very prominent candidates, in the case of PDP, the former vice president under President Obasanjo, and for the APC, the great politician from Lagos, Tinubu. One surprise was that former President Obasanjo of the PDP was this time supporting Peter Obi because he believes a new generation of leadership is needed in the country. But in the last few weeks, tumult had descended on the country, mainly because the governor of the central bank decided to change the currency of Nigeria from the old to the new. Although they never pronounced themselves, there were whispering speculation that the reason this was being done was to minimize voter buying. But things became far more complicated than was envisaged. It turned out that the banks did not have sufficient of the new notes, and citizens have to stay long in line to make these changes. Then some governors appealed to the courts, and the court intervened, stating that the bank should withhold its deadline and hoping to give its final decision this Wednesday, 3 days from the voting. But the chaos continued, and President Buhari had to intervene in a broadcast, creating more confusion, postponing the deadline to the 10th of April after the elections. The bank president felt that the independence was being compromised, but this did not stop people from attacking banks and making life miserable for the average citizen. So the first thing we have to ask ourselves, what will be the turnout in these circumstances? I've already mentioned that the expectation is that the youth will turn out in large numbers. But some are saying that if they do not have cash, it may be difficult for them to go out to vote. The Electoral Commission itself has said that there will be no election in some areas because citizens have not registered at all. At another time, they have mentioned that people are not picking up their voter cards, which are necessary to vote. But this time, too, in Nigeria, there is greater confidence in the Electoral Commission. The Commission itself has pledged to have a peaceful, smooth voting on an equal level playing field. But the Commission cannot squeeze out of stone. Also, due to the insecurity and mayhem in the country, the security forces have promised that they will secure the safety and security of all voters. But some are very skeptical. So we are left with a situation where it is very difficult to predict the outcome of this election. All Africans can do at this stage is to hope for a smooth transition of power and to hope that security is maintained. This is all that Africans outside of Nigeria can propose, because it would be very great if at the end of the day, at the end of the voting process, Nigeria would have participated in this act of democratic change. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday here on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect with music from the continent.
No pure on my way out. Bulabalu, anytime we stay back. The men them outside, we know they us. No they look for us, we know they us. No they see the mula, we don't spray us. Thank God, say the don't pay out. Okay, see, I'm ahead of them, I see what you. I'm a baller, girl only me. No man fit up to me, feel me. You go collect, see, I'm on a me daily, I see what you. I'm a chase my friends and click. When I call them, I all pulling up. We strapped up with the guns and the swords and things. Bring hell to anybody we try to see. I'm your dad, I'm your uncle, I'm your popsy. I be old man, no go, they call me Gen Z. Bread I see, steady giving them the multi love power. They can never near me. I smile about lover, just go. But oh, you know what? Don't show. I'm on my polo white, my face show. Sweet boy for life, you don't know. You're serious, babe, they worry my phone. You got this up for back, you don't know. Every day with you run, I'm on call. Supposed to know how the thing go. Man, get in high till I fade out. Give the vibe, no pure on my way out. Pull a ball, anytime we stay back. The men, them outside, we know they ask. No, they look for us, we know they ask. So they see the mula, we don't spray out. Thank God, said him, don't pay out. Okay, see, I'm ahead of them, I see what you. I'm a baller, you got only me. No man fit up to me, he look me, you go collect. See, I'm on a me daily, I see what you. I'm a baller, you got only me. No man fit up to me, he look me, you go collect. I'm on a different stage. Singlet belt and ripped up jeans. Man to as I know if you lose that cheese. Oluwa thunder my body with blessings. When you leave that team. When I say kukuru cook that team. Who you check a moya look that team. Face white, black, I rebuke that team. With nobody try stress me, I know be JJC. I don't know if you get it on a top rating. I feel it with the best team. You won't race me, we know they do the same thing. Can I no be just key, I'ma you stay waiting, no go easy me less. I'ma you go top creeping, I do it diligently. Won't let me, hurry back me. Man getting high till I fade out. Give the vibe no pure on my way out. Pull a ball, anytime we stay about. You men them outside, we know they ask. No they look for us, we know they ask. No they see the mula, we don't spray out. Thank God, said the not pay out. Okay, tonight till I fade out. You divide no pure on my way out. Pull a ball, anytime we stay about. You men them outside, we know they us. No they look for us, we know they us. Do they see the mula, we don't spray out. Thank God, said the don't pay out. Okay,
mapenzi yanakupa power. Nipatie intention. Siruki ushanivunja mbawa. Umenigea dozi, umezidisha dozi. Nimetepeka dama jozi, dama jozi. We gon' spend life. Many a dozy, yeah. Oh, many pa dozy, yeah. You met a peta, dama jose, yeah. Dama jose, yeah. Let's have good life. Ni take it when I mean me. Ni take it when I mean me, yeah. Ni take it when I mean me, oh, me, oh, me, oh, me, oh, me, oh, me, oh. Ni take it when I mean me. Ni take it when I mean me, love. Ni take it when I mean me, mom.
south coast, man. I'm telling her approach, man. The ex-saka, you can afford, man. So keep a goalie, shaw, moye, genye, na rope.
Ni teke uwe na mini. Ni teke uwe na mini. Ni teke uwe na mini. Oh, mini, oh, mia, mia, mia. Ni teke uwe na mini. Ni teke uwe na mini, love. Ni teke uwe na mini. Coca-Cola, babe. We Coca-Cola. Uzamtolo wa matola. Sia take over. Mzimba wa kwi Coca-Cola, babe. We Coca-Cola. Ama inya inya. Zokchengela ma inya inya. Ipate tula. Kistengenga mayure ingila. Nidale. Ama inya inya. Zokchengela ma inya inya. Ni teke uwe na mini, ni teke uwe na mini, ni teke uwe na mini, oh mini, oh mia, mia, mia. Ni teke uwe na mini, ni teke uwe na mini, love. Ni teke uwe na mini, man.
Sunday Music Sport on Nightline Africa from the English service of the Voice of America. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us tonight. Hope you enjoyed the program. And as you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Join us again on Saturday. Have a great evening. I'm Douglas Impoga in Washington.